The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Today's world news, what it means, where it's taking us.
I bring you the one and only possible message of world peace.
This is a message of hope, tremendous hope. And he said unto me, you must prophesy again.
The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Hello, everyone. Welcome back to the Trumpet Daily. My name's Brad McDonald, and I'll be your host today. Well, I had the strong inclination this morning to speak with you again about Europe and the migrant crisis in Europe and the transformative impact that that crisis is having on Germany and the Balkans and Europe in general. It seems that every day there's another pretty dramatic development in this crisis. Last week, we talked about how Horst Seehofer, the premier of the state of Bavaria in Germany, was turning on Angela Merkel, Germany's chancellor. He was really pressuring her to make changes and to change and to stop the migrant crisis. Well, yesterday, Seehofer came out and he gave Angela Merkel an ultimatum. He told her that she has until Sunday to figure out a meaningful solution to the migrant crisis. And if she doesn't figure out a solution, then Seehofer is going to consider options for action. That's what he said. So we need to keep watching this crisis. Anyway, I thought I'd pull myself away from Europe just for a moment, just for today. And I thought I'd speak to you about another subject. To begin with, to launch into today's subject, I thought I'd just share with you a section from a book I read a couple of months ago. And this book is about Vladimir Putin, the president of Russia. The title of the book is The Man Without a Face, The Unlikely Rise of Vladimir Putin. And it's written by a woman by the name of Masha Gessen. And Gessen is a Russian journalist and author. She lived in Moscow, was born in Moscow. She's worked at a number of the largest media organizations in Russia. She's a very credible source when it comes to discussing Vladimir Putin. She has a lot of friends who have been persecuted and even killed by Vladimir Putin. She's rubbed shoulders with some of the top leaders in Russian industry and Russian politics. So this woman, she understands and she knows Vladimir Putin, and she went ahead and she wrote this book, The Man Without a Face, The Unlikely Rise of Vladimir Putin. But in one section of the book, Gessen explores a series of terrorist attacks that occurred in Moscow and a few other Russian cities in 1999. In the summer, between August and September 1999, there were 5 or 6 separate bomb attacks in Russia. 2 or 3 of them occurred in Moscow, and as I mentioned, a couple of others occurred in other cities. And quite a few people were killed, many more were injured. And these attacks really struck fear and alarm in Russians. A lot of people were just really frightened by this slew of attacks that occurred in Russia. And as we'll see here later on, it was this spate of attacks that really was instrumental in Vladimir Putin's rise to power. He was prime minister. He'd just become prime minister when these attacks occurred. And by the end of that year, 1999, he was the president of Russia. But here's what's interesting. At the time, everyone was absolutely certain that these terrorist attacks were conducted by Chechen rebels. Now, Chechnya is just a little slither of territory in the Caucasus, close to the Caspian Sea. And after the dissolution of the Soviet Empire, half of Chechnya tried to break away from Russia and declare independence. That didn't go down well with Moscow. a major conflict develop, and there were actually some wars between Russia and this slither of Chechnya that wanted to break away. But here in 1999, when these terrorist attacks occurred, everyone had no doubt that they were being conducted by Chechenian rebels. Everyone knew that these terrorist attacks were being conducted by Chechenian rebels. Now, at the time, the president of Russia was Boris Yeltsin, and as I mentioned, Vladimir Putin was prime minister. But Putin was preparing himself to run for president in national elections that would occur within the year. But in the book, Gessen just makes the point that Vladimir Putin had been prime minister for 3 weeks when this spate of bombings occurred. But in the book, Gessen recounts the foiling of a bomb attack in the Russian city of Ryazan. And she goes through and she just documents how this terrorist attack was foiled. On September 22nd, they were told about three mysterious bags that were in the cellar of an apartment building. The police came out, they opened these bags, and they saw that they were filled with explosives, and they were wired to explode later on that night. So the police evacuated the building and the surrounding area, and then they called in the bomb squad, and there were about 1,200 people standing on the street as the bomb squad went ahead and disarmed these explosives. And one thing Gessen shows, and that's a known fact, is that the bomb, this bomb was constructed the same way and using the same ingredients as the other bombs had been in the other attacks that had occurred in Moscow and in these one or two other Russian cities. So clearly, these bombs were the work of the same people who conducted these other successful attacks. Now, at the time, as I mentioned, everyone thought that this bomb was the work of Chechenian rebels, and that was what was sold by the Russian media and the Russian government. But in the next day or two, as local police started investigating these bombs, a trail of facts developed that actually pointed toward the FSB, Russia's Federal Security Service, formerly the KGB, being involved in these attacks and in the planting of these bombs. And Gessen, she documents some of the facts that showed that maybe the FSB was involved. One witness saw a Russian-made vehicle pull up outside the building, and he watched as two people unloaded these sacks in the cellar of this apartment building. So this trail of facts began to develop that pointed to the FSB, Russia's security service, as being responsible for planting these bombs. And as I mentioned, these bombs were built the same way and using the same ingredients as the bombs or the explosives that were used in some of the successful terrorist attacks that occurred in the days and weeks prior. 2 or 3 days after the discovery of these three bombs, Russia's interior minister, he gave a press conference. And in that press conference, he stated that there'd been some positive developments in the investigation of this foiled attack. They were starting to figure out now who was responsible for this. They'd actually dispatched more than 1,200 police officers to track down the Chechenian rebels who they thought were responsible for this foiled attack. But as Gessen recounts in her book, 30 minutes after the Russia's interior minister gave their press conference, the head of the FSB, he came out and he gave a press conference too. And the head of the FSB was a friend of Vladimir Putin's. He'd actually been appointed to that position by Vladimir Putin. But the head of the FSB came out and he said that actually this foiled terrorist attack was really an FSB training exercise. That these bombs were fake bombs, that the bags were actually just full of sugar, and that they'd been intentionally planted in the apartment building by the FSB as part of a training exercise. Now, as Gessen recounts, you know, there were 1,200 people that were evacuated in this. There were people who saw, there were local police officers who saw inside the bags and actually saw the explosives and the way they were wired. But the FSB came out and it said, well, actually, this was all part of a training exercise. And, you know, what was going on here was the FSB had realized that local police were beginning to trace the attack to the FSB. So they came out and they preempted the discovery that they were actually responsible for the planting of these bombs. Now, there was a lot, you know, that didn't add up with that story that the FSB sold to the Russian people. The local chapter of the FSB, the FSB branch in Ryazan, this Russian city, they had no idea about this training exercise. As I mentioned, the local police forces had dispatched 1,200 police officers to search for the Chechenian terrorists. Why would that happen if this was just a training exercise? Russia's Interior Ministry hadn't been informed of the training exercise. They went on television and they said that they were making progress in finding out who planted this bomb. It was the FSB. Here's what Gessen writes in her book. She says, 6 months later, and after collecting the facts, I could not believe the FSB had most likely been behind the deadly bombings that shook Russia and helped make Putin its leader. When the agency suddenly found itself on the verge of being exposed, the FSB quickly came up with the training exercise story. Unconvincing, but sufficient to prevent the arrest of secret police agents by regular police. The deadly chain of explosions halted at the same time. Well, what do you know? That's pretty remarkable. These supposed terrorist attacks, they stopped after this foiled attack and after local police forces began to trace the attack to the Russian security force, the FSB, that Vladimir Putin was a part of for pretty much all of his life, and which was formerly the KGB. I'll just read a quote from Boris Berezovsky. He was a Russian oligarch. He owned two or three energy companies in Russia. He owned a number of media companies. And Berezovsky was a close friend of Vladimir Putin's in the beginning. He was a good friend of Putin's in the 90s when Putin was in the KGB, or the FSB, sorry. And Berezovsky was a supporter, and he really helped bring Putin to power. He initiated a media campaign in his newspapers that really promoted Vladimir Putin. But they, not long after Putin became president, they fell out. And Berezovsky had to actually move to London because he feared for his life. And in fact, he was found dead in his apartment in London in 2003. And the coroner, he was found hanged. And the coroner has said that it's an open case, the implication being he was hanged, but they're not exactly sure of the circumstances of his hanging. But here is what this man, who was close to Putin, said after he'd moved to London. He said, I can tell you with absolute sincerity that at the time I was sure it was the Chechens. It was when I came here to London and started looking back that I eventually came to the conclusion that the explosions were organized by the FSB. And this conclusion was based not only on logic, not even so much on logic as on facts. See, there were plenty of facts to prove that the FSB and Vladimir Putin were actually behind this series of bombings. Berezovsky continues, but at the same time, I did not see those facts. The FSB was behind the explosions, and they were intended, that the explosions, that is, they were intended to unite Russians in fear and in a desperate desire for a new, decisive, even aggressive leader who would spare no enemy. Isn't that remarkable? Those attacks in Moscow and those terrorist attacks in August and September of 1999, they were instrumental to Putin's rise to power. Boris Yeltsin, as I mentioned, he was old. And a lot of people just became very quickly disenfranchised about how he was looking to solve these terrorist attacks. And a movement, within weeks, a movement began in Russia begging Yeltsin to retire and to give leadership of Russia to Vladimir Putin. Meanwhile, Vladimir Putin, the prime minister, he was making tough statements about these terrorist attacks. He was tapping into the frustration and the anger and the fear and the anxiety of the Russian people. He was tapping into that and exploiting it. This is what he said September 23rd in 1999 after one of those terrorist attacks. This is what he said on television. We will hunt them down. Wherever we find them, we will destroy them. Even if we find them in the toilet, we'll run them out in the outhouse. We'll snuff them out in the outhouse. And that message from Putin really appealed to the Russian people because naturally they were anxious. They were alarmed by this spate of terrorist attacks. They were looking for someone to go in there and confront these Chechens. In fact, it was Vladimir Putin and the FSB who was responsible for those attacks. Here's what Gessen says in her book. Putin was using rhetoric markedly different from Yeltsin's. Putin was not promising to bring the terrorists to justice, nor was he expressing compassion for the hundreds of victims of the explosions. This was the language of a leader who was planning to rule with his fist. These sorts of vulgar statements, often spiced with below-the-belt humor, would become Putin's signature oratorical device. Putin's popularity began to soar as a result of his response to these terrorist attacks, which he sold to the Russian people as being caused by Chechenian rebels. See, this is Vladimir Putin. This is the character and the personality of the man that leads Russia. And I thought I'd share this account on radio today because, obviously it reveals Putin's true nature. But sometimes I think a lot of us, you know, we know that Vladimir Putin is a bad man. We know that Vladimir Putin isn't a very nice man. But I don't think a lot of us here in the West really understand just how ruthless this man is, just how vicious he is. And, you know, reading this book by Gessen, she provides multiple examples and the facts proving them or supporting these examples. But she provides multiple examples of Putin dissenters or Putin critics, journalists, politicians, businessmen being persecuted, being stalked, being assaulted in their homes, being threatened. She was threatened herself. She came home one evening and her apartment had been ransacked and everything demolished because she'd been on TV making remarks critical of Vladimir Putin and his policies. She documents businessmen and journalists and politicians being poisoned, being hung, being shot. This is Vladimir Putin. This is Vladimir Putin. He is a frightening individual. And if you go back and if you look at Putin's politics since 2000, when he became Russia's president, he's really followed this or employed this same modus operandi. You look at what he did in Crimea and Ukraine. He manufactures or he exaggerates a threat to arouse alarm and anxiety in the Russian people. And then he presents himself as the solution to that threat, as the solution to that crisis. He did that in Crimea and Ukraine. I mean, first of all, I guess he denied Russia's involvement. But that became impossible after a while. So he exaggerated stories about the way Russians in eastern Ukraine were being unfairly treated. He promoted this narrative that the Russian people, or that the eastern Ukrainians, they're the comrades of the Russian people, that he promoted this narrative that they were being mistreated by Kiev and that they were being threatened by Kiev's or Western Ukraine's movement or gravitation toward the European Union. And he built this sympathy in the Russian people for the people of Eastern Ukraine. And then exploiting that sympathy or tapping into that sympathy, he sent the Russian military in there to invade Eastern Ukraine. It's the same thing is happening in Syria. Vladimir Putin is selling his escapades in Syria as an effort to confront ISIS. And it's successful. It's successful. Let me just read a quote from a Wall Street Journal article from yesterday. And this article just makes the point about how popular Vladimir Putin is and how his popularity is rising as a result of Russia's actions in Ukraine. This Wall Street Journal article says, "The Russian government is waging a campaign at home for hearts and minds over Syria." And it talks about how the Russian government is releasing all these flashy videos showing Russian planes dropping bombs and missiles on targets in Syria. Russia says it's carrying out precision strikes to avoid hitting civilians. That's what a Kremlin spokesman said. Indeed, the images released show a slick, sanitized vision of war, emphasizing Russia's ability to wage high-tech warfare. It talks about how the Russian government is really showing the Russian people how they're confronting Islamic State terrorists. You know, they're doing the job that America and Britain refuse to do. And it's working. It's working. But this is Vladimir Putin. This is Vladimir Putin. He orchestrated a series of terrorist attacks on his own people in his own city, Moscow, to arouse fear and hatred for the Chechens. And then he tapped into that fear and anxiety and that frustration. He tapped into that to have himself elected or made the president of Russia. And then he set about going to war with Chechnya again. And this history is documented, but it's hard to find because Vladimir Putin controls the media in Russia and he shuts down opponents very quickly and very violently. This is Vladimir Putin. This is the man that America's president or former president George Bush, this is the man that Bush about whom Bush said, "I looked the man in the eye. I found him to be very straightforward and trustworthy, and we had very good dialogue. I was able to get a sense of his soul." That's what President Bush said about Vladimir Putin. Honestly, most of the West has no sense of Vladimir Putin's soul. President Obama, Prime Minister Cameron, a lot of Western leaders, I don't think they really understand the true nature of Vladimir Putin. They think he's crazy. They don't take him too seriously. They think he's a flash in the pan. It was, I think, John Kerry, America's Secretary of State, who said that, you know, Vladimir Putin, well, he's just living in the 19th century. The way he operates, he's operating like a man in the 19th century. They don't realize, or they don't really see, that Vladimir Putin, he plays the game with a take-no-prisoners approach. He's absolutely ruthless. He's totally calloused when it comes to human suffering. And there isn't anything he won't do to achieve his ambitions. Again, America doesn't see this. The West doesn't see this. When the media reports on Putin, you know, too often it kind of paints him as, you know, he's akin to a schoolyard bully, or, you know, Vladimir Putin is kind of the naughty boy who needs to go stand in the corner. We know he's bad, but I don't think most people in the West really realize and really see and understand the nature of this man. Actually, there's a lot of people here in the West that find Vladimir Putin somewhat appealing. There's sometimes you'll see people with a real fascination with his personality and his behavior. Putin is strong. Putin is decisive. Putin is uncompromising. Putin is masculine. Putin tends to be, you know, conservative. He tends to be more traditional. Vladimir Putin, he defends traditional families. He's prepared to confront Islamist terrorism. He's not politically correct. And it's easy. In some ways, it's natural. It's easy to almost like that about Vladimir Putin. It's easy to find his leadership and his personality somewhat appealing, especially if you're frustrated with the behavior of Barack Obama or Prime Minister Cameron, and the politically and how politically correct they are, and how they just can't make a decision, and how they're just prepared to allow their countries be bulldozed, and they won't stand up for what's right. They just blow in the wind. That is frustrating to watch here in the nations of Israel. And in that environment, Vladimir Putin can actually look pretty appealing. But don't forget who this man is. Don't be fooled. Vladimir Putin is a dangerous, dangerous man. He's a cruel, egotistical tyrant. And he has a voracious determination to emasculate the West, especially America, to expand Russia's power and influence, and to establish Moscow as the world power. He is a threat to America and to Britain and to the West in general. He's quickly emerging as the world's strongman. And look at what he did to his own people. Look at what he did to his own people to become the leader of Russia. Is there anything he won't do to Americans or the British? We should be concerned about Vladimir Putin. And it's frustrating to see how the West responds to Vladimir Putin. He's taken Crimea and basically expanded Russia's border now into Europe. He's built an alliance with Eastern countries, China and India, that is designed to oppose and undermine America and the West. He's forging himself, even now, he's forging himself as the supreme kingmaker in the Middle East. Putin is the linchpin of Middle East politics. Charles Krauthammer made this point in his article last Friday. He wrote, "Guess who just popped up in the Kremlin? Bashar al-Assad, Syrian dictator and destroyer. Now Vladimir Putin's newest pet. After 4 years holed up in Damascus, Assad was summoned to Russia to bend a knee to Putin. Show the world that today Middle East questions get settled not in Washington, but in Moscow. And officially bless the Russian-led four-nation takeover of Syria, now underway. See, Vladimir Putin is in charge of the Middle East, or he's working to be in charge of the Middle East. And it's easy, and a lot of people have the response to that reality that, well, let him have the Middle East. That's essentially what President Obama believes. I'm going to let Putin have the Middle East. It's an absolute mess. It's a disaster. You can't get anything right. He can have it. If he wants it, he can have it. He can control the Middle East. That doesn't make sense. Do we want an individual as ruthless and calloused and anti-Western and anti-American as Vladimir Putin running the Middle East, where most of the world's oil comes from, where Iran is about to get nuclear weapons, where there are multiple terrorist actors? Do we really want to hand that region to a man who's capable of bombing his own people? It doesn't make sense. It doesn't make sense. President Obama and Prime Minister Cameron, they should be far more concerned about what Russia is doing in the Middle East, but they're not. In some ways, you get the impression that some Western leaders are relieved. They're relieved that someone else is going to take on ISIS. But we don't want a man of Vladimir Putin's personality and nature in charge of the Middle East. Krauthammer concluded his article with a really interesting remark. In the penultimate paragraph, Krauthammer recounted an interview that President Obama did with 60 Minutes. 60 Minutes asked Obama, "Are you concerned about yielding leadership to Russia?" That's what 60 Minutes asked America's president. "Are you concerned about yielding leadership to Russia?" And President Obama responded dismissively, and he said, "Propping up a weak ally is not leadership. I'm leading the world on climate change." So his view was Vladimir Putin can lead in the Middle East. He can lead in Syria. He can lead in these areas that are of enormous strategic and financial importance to the world. But, you know, America's leading on the issue of climate change. I mean, Barack Obama's really not too concerned about Vladimir Putin and what he's doing in the Middle East and elsewhere. And here's how Krauthammer concluded his article after just recounting that 60 Minutes interview and President Obama's response to that question. Krauthammer said, "Upon hearing that, anyone in any conflict anywhere who has put his trust in the United States should start packing his bags for Germany." That's really interesting. Krauthammer, I mean, Germany doesn't come up anywhere else in the article. Anywhere else in the article. But it's the concluding word of the article. But basically, Krauthammer's point was, listen, America is not concerned about Vladimir Putin and what Russia's doing. And if you want to be safe from Putin, or if you want someone that is capable of confronting Putin, then start packing your bags and head to Germany. I would have loved for Krauthammer to elaborate more on that point. Why Germany? Clearly, Krauthammer sees Germany as being the counter force to Russia. And he's right. That's exactly what Bible prophecy says is going to happen. Vladimir Putin may be emerging as the world's strongman. It may seem like he's almost taking over the world. He's almost like a character out of a James Bond movie, an old James Bond movie. Except America lacks a James Bond. America lacks a leader or an agent capable of stopping Vladimir Putin. But as Krauthammer hinted at here, there someone will arise to confront Vladimir Putin and Vladimir Putin's Russia. And that strongman is going to come from Europe. And the history of Europe shows that the continent is more than capable of producing someone who can match Putin, someone who's capable of opposing Putin and standing up to Vladimir Putin. But here's the thing. To stand up to Vladimir Putin, you're going to have the nature and the character and the personality of Vladimir Putin. This leader of Europe is going to have to be equally as tough and uncompromising and ruthless. You need to, if you haven't read it already, we have a fantastic article on Vladimir Putin and his significance in biblical prophecy. The title of that article is Vladimir Putin the Prophesied Prince of Rosh? And it was written by the Trumpet's editor-in-chief, Gerald Flurry. It's an outstanding article, and it's remarkable how prescient that article is today, even though it was written years ago. But request that article at thetrumpet.com. Request that article at thetrumpet.com and make sure you're keeping track of Vladimir Putin and what he's up to. And don't get caught up in this narrative that, you know, Vladimir Putin is just a bit of a bad boy. He's a naughty boy. You know, he's a bully. Vladimir Putin is much worse than a bully. He's much more than a naughty boy. He is a dangerous man. He's a terrifying individual. And he's a man that we should all be concerned about. Okay, we'll go ahead now and take a short break, and then we'll come back and I'll finish off by talking about something else.
From the Philadelphia Church of God campus in Edstone, England, this is the Trumpet Daily Program.
Welcome back to the Trumpet Daily. I'm Brad McDonald, and I'm taking the program today for Stephen Flurry. He'll be back in the studio tomorrow. Earlier this week, I watched a movie with my family that was built around the events of Hurricane Katrina, that massive hurricane that struck New Orleans and the state of Louisiana. I think it was 2008 or 2009. And it really was just a devastating natural disaster. Nearly 2,000 people were killed. Thousands more people were injured. And just watching this movie, and you know, it had images. It really captured the moment when the hurricane was approaching, and there were news alerts and things like that. But one thing that came through just watching this movie was just a contrast in the way people viewed the approaching storm. There were some people who they would watch the news, and as the weather experts became more extreme, these people, you know, they rushed around their home, they packed their suitcases, they got in their car, and they just left New Orleans. They were getting out of there. These people, they could see, or they sensed that there was a massive crisis brewing. You could say these people had a strong sense of crisis. They knew Katrina was different. They could see its trajectory, and they fled New Orleans a day or two or three or even more before the storm struck. And those people, they were safe. You know, they would make it to another state, and they survived Katrina. But in the movie, it clearly shows that there were also plenty of people who weren't nearly as in tune with the approaching hurricane. Everybody in New Orleans and Louisiana knew that there was a hurricane approaching. But there were quite a few people who basically ignored it. They downplayed it. There were quite a few people that just expected it to change course and to strike farther up or down the coast. There were some, you know, most people expected the levees to hold in New Orleans. Some people, this came through in the movie too, some people thought that the authorities were just exaggerating. But basically, you know, these folks didn't have a strong sense of crisis. They didn't have a strong sense of crisis. They didn't really realize the magnitude of the storm that was about to strike them. And they stayed in New Orleans. And at least in the movie, they all survived. But, you know, they had to go to the football stadium, and it was just a horrible experience. But the difference between these two groups of people really was this sense of crisis. Those who escaped had a strong sense of crisis. They could tell. They were watching the news. They were thinking about what the facts and what they were witnessing. And because they believed what they were witnessing, because they knew this was dangerous, they were able to escape. They were motivated to leave New Orleans. Now, what about you? What about us? What about me? How strong is your sense of crisis? I think it's safe to say that if you look at the world today, there's at least half a dozen Hurricane Katrina-sized crises hovering over this world. Major, major calamities that will inflict massive destruction. How are you responding? Do we have a strong sense of crisis? Is there a sense of urgency? Or is a sense of urgency aroused as we watch these crises develop? The migrant crisis, Vladimir Putin's rise and the resurgence of Russia, the social breakdown and the racial and tension in America, the multiple economic crises all over the world. What's happening in Jerusalem and the conflict between Palestinians and Jews, Iran's pursuit of nuclear weapons. These are Hurricane Katrina-sized issues. Are we responding? Do we sense the crisis? Let's just look at a scripture here in 1 Peter 4 and verse 7. Peter says, But the end of all things is at hand. Be you therefore sober and watch unto prayer. The end of all things is nearly here. Be you therefore sober and watch unto prayer. Be sober, be serious, Peter says. You know, as you see these major end time events happening in the world, the chief apostle says, be serious, be a serious thinker. Be sober, be vigilant. And watch unto prayer. Pay attention to your world and then respond by turning to God. That's what Peter's saying here. But it's interesting that he says, be you therefore sober. I mean, did God inspire that? Because he knew that so many in this end time are actually drunk, you know, drunk on materialism, drunk on pursuing selfish pursuits, drunk on sports, drunk on entertainment. We really do live in a world, especially the Western world, that is the antithesis of sober. Our culture is just drunk on selfishness and vain pursuits and the latest movies or, you know, football or NBA or video games or, you know, buying the fanciest car or social media, Twitter and Facebook. People are just drunk on tweeting and seeing who favorited their tweets and how many posts or reposts they have on Facebook. All of these inconsequential trends, all of these inconsequential actions, and they don't see what's happening in the world around them. Where God says, be sober, be serious, spend most of your mental time thinking on serious things. I mean, everything in balance. There's a time for recreation. There's a time to watch a movie or to watch a basketball game. There's a time for that. But Paul says, you know, Peter says, be sober. Don't revolve your life around sports or don't revolve your life around material interests. Be sober, be serious, think on serious things. Develop a sense of crisis. I'll just read a quote here from the Epistles of Peter booklet written by Mr. Gerald Flurry. And you can have this booklet free, if you like, by going to thetrumpet.com and requesting it. But here's what Mr. Flurry says. Today, the end of all things truly is at hand. So we must take Peter's point to heart. Because time is so short, we must be sober and watch unto prayer. The fact that Christ's return is so near should change our behavior. That's really a pretty profound point to think on. Do the events, do the catastrophic events that are building around us, do they cause us to change our behavior? Sadly, you look at this, you look at most people, and that is not the case. But what about you? What about me? Does the fact of Christ's imminent return change our behavior? Mr. Flurry continues, sober means to be of a sound mind, having curbed one's passions and exercised self-control. Is there a single one of us who couldn't do a better job of curbing our passions and exercising self-control? Further down, he continues, Peter admonishes us to examine our lives to see where we can do more. The knowledge of Christ's imminent return should make us urgent spiritually. Look at the time frame. Have a sense of crisis and a sense of hope. You see, those people in New Orleans before Hurricane Katrina struck, those people who had a sense of crisis, those people who watched the news and really listened and paid attention to what was happening and then prepared for it, they escaped the crisis because they were vigilant, they were watching, and they were sober-minded. Now, it's the same for us in this world, isn't it? There are so many Hurricane Katrinas, massive destructive crises that are just building. You know, it's as if we're in New Orleans 2 or 3 days before the hurricane strike, and we can look out across the ocean, or we can watch the weather models, and we can see the massive storms brewing. You can see it in the Middle East. You can see it in Europe. You can see it in American society, in British society, these massive storms brewing. And they haven't necessarily made landfall, or at least, you know, the bulk of the storm hasn't made landfall just yet. And how are we responding? Are we going to be like those people in New Orleans who had a sense of crisis and they responded and they avoided the calamity? Or are we sometimes like the other group where they see the crisis building, but, well, they think it's afar off. They think it'll strike somewhere else. They think it'll be okay. They think that they can survive it. The levees will hold. It's just worth thinking about. Mr. Flurry concludes this section. If we don't have a sense of crisis, we are out of touch with reality. See, if you want to be in touch with reality, if you want to escape what's coming, if you want solutions to the crises that are building around us, then develop a sense of crisis. Be sober and watch unto prayer. Get close to God. Ask God to guide you. Ask God to provide a way out. Ask God to provide a solution. I'll just conclude in Matthew 24. Matthew 24, verses 36 through 39. Jesus Christ compares how our societies would be here in this end time to the way it was just before the flood, Noah's flood. Christ says, but of that day and hour knows no man, no, not the angels of heaven, but my Father only. But as the days of Noah were, so shall also the coming of the Son of Man be. For as in the days of Noah that were before the flood, they were eating and drinking, marrying and giving in marriage, until the day that Noah entered into the ark, and knew not until the flood came and took them all away, so also shall the coming of man be. So it's just like the days of Noah, where society is partying. Society, you know, most people are just fixated on material things, self-gratification, what they can do that night, you know, how much fun they can have, what kind of material wealth they can develop, what they can buy next, how good they can look in their new jeans and their new shoes. They're just fixated on those things, and they have no idea about what's building in the world around them and in the community around them and in the nation around them. Don't be like that. Don't be like that. Luke 21 is the parallel chapter to Matthew 24. And in verse 46 of Luke 21, Christ says, "Watch you therefore." Same instruction that Peter gave us. "Watch you therefore." Pay attention to what really matters. "Watch you therefore and pray always that you may be accounted worthy to escape all these things that shall come to pass and to stand before the Son of Man." You see, there is a way of escape. There was a way of escape as Hurricane Katrina bore down on New Orleans. And there's a way of escape today as multiple Hurricane Katrinas bear down on humanity. You can escape. But to know how to escape, you're going to have to watch. You're going to have to be sober. You're going to have to be vigilant. You're going to have to be serious-minded, paying attention to what really matters. But if you do that, and if you let the urgency of the times, and if you let your strong sense of crisis drive you to your knees and into a closer relationship with God, then everything will be okay. There will be a way of escape. There's always a way of escape when we're close to Jesus Christ and God. There's always a way of escape. Okay, it was good to be with you. I'm not sure when I'll be back, but I'm sure it won't be too long.